baseball fans, and welcome to a podcast to be named later. I am your host, Chris Mitchell. Thanks for coming on board today and listening to the program. This is going to be a fantastic show, hopefully like all the others. We're going to be talking baseball for the hour or so with Jay Jaffe from SportsIllustrated.com. Lots going on out there. Obviously, the season starts up in a few days. And before the season even gets started, of course, there's probably more news, more exciting news, than when the season actually does begin. You need to temper expectations a little bit in that first week. You've got bad weather. You've got people that are a little bit rusty. Batters getting their timing going. Pitchers kind of getting things acclimated, getting their feel for the game. I realize that spring training can be pretty long, but it seems like there's a different intensity, a different level once the season gets going. So you've got to be patient a little bit. And right now, there's no reason for patience. There's craziness going on. For example, up here in Boston where I am, Pablo Sandoval has been sent to the bench. Travis Shaw has won the position battle, which is kind of surprising, not to me, because I thought the Pablo Sandoval signing was atrocious. I thought it was a horrible signing before it even happened. Then when it actually happened, I was disgusted that it was as much as it was at $95 million. I can't stop talking about it. And now he goes out there, and now he's in his second season about to begin. He was awful in his first year, which was no surprise. He declined for three straight seasons in San Francisco before the Red Sox grossly overpaid him. He comes here, declines again, has his worst season ever, and then he comes into camp completely out of shape, can't even bend over in order to field his position. And so there's a mess there. He loses his job. And just recently today, new news, he lost his job yesterday or the day before. And now his agent comes out, and the quote from John Heyman is, "If you want to win a World Series, then you don't leave your Ferrari in the garage," which is a comical and just a completely tone-deaf comment from the agent. We hear that he's a Beverly Hills agent out in California, and maybe he doesn't realize being out on the West Coast and the completely and totally different attitude of things going on out there. Maybe he believes that Pablo Sandoval is a celebrity that automatically deserves respect, and we just assume that he's a great player, even though the numbers don't reflect it at all. I don't know the mindset of an agent who says something. Let's be honest. I try to be kind and polite a little bit, but an agent that says something as stupid as that in a Boston market, I mean, we're hostile up here. We're aggressive. We're pessimistic. We're negative. We're extremely critical, and we don't hold our tongues, as you can probably tell if you've listened to any of my programs. And he comes out and says something as dumb as that. Never mind the numbers. Let's ignore the performance on the field. Why would you compare a guy who is a professional athlete who would be described fairly as obese? That's a word I don't think you want to be connected to if you're a professional athlete. It's one thing to be out of shape. It's one thing to be maybe a little bit chunky. But to physically and medically, officially be able to be declared obese for a professional athlete, that's just not very good. So then you compare an obese athlete to a Ferrari, that's a visual image that just doesn't connect and doesn't make a lot of sense. So the agent is getting ripped up here in Boston. And then Pablo Sandoval yesterday came out with comments when it was announced that he was going to be starting the season on the bench. He says that he's happy. and the people up here in Boston are just trying to say, well, maybe there's a language barrier here. And so he said happy, but he didn't really mean happy. Maybe he meant okay, but because he was dealing in a second language that maybe somehow he said happy. I mean, I don't know. He's happy that he was benched. He's happy he's getting $95 million. Maybe that's what he was answering. Maybe he misunderstood the question and was addressing his contract rather than his status on the field. But either way, up here in Boston, Travis Shaw is going to be the starting third baseman, at least to start the season. And Pablo Sandoval is going to be starting on the bench. And there's nothing you can do about it. And it's one of the flaws probably in Major League Baseball, which is great for the union. Very powerful now. They get a lot of things that they want done. These automatic contracts, these guaranteed contracts, there's nothing you can do. Even if a player comes in and is completely and totally irresponsible and does not live up to any of his commitments to the organization, essentially, as long as he shows up to the field, he gets his money. So it doesn't matter that he comes in in horrible shape. It doesn't matter if he doesn't even work at his craft. And the Red Sox have another player like that in Hanley Ramirez that fits that description as well, though. They claim he's really working hard this spring, so I guess we'll see that as the season goes along. But these guys get their money as long as they show up on the field. I mean, if they skip games, which Babe Ruth was rumored to just skip games outright, and there was nothing they could really do about that, that's ironic. But nonetheless, big story up here in Boston. Position battles have, for the most part, been decided. Fifth starters have been announced. The season is only a few days away. Lots to get into. Jose Reyes, another story that we won't get into today, but his domestic abuse case has been dropped by the Hawaii District Attorney's Office and wherever that location is that they were addressing that because the alleged victim is unwilling to cooperate, which is unfortunate. Domestic violence is an awful thing. It's really terrible, and unfortunately, this isn't uncommon from what I understand. You know, people that are involved in these, they don't want to harm the person that harmed them, and it's really an awful situation. But nonetheless, a lot of people didn't know Jose Reyes' status. There was speculation that the Rockies didn't want him back, and you can understand why you would not exactly love to have a person who has done something like this. But again, it was alleged. We'll never, I guess, possibly never find out what exactly happened. But either way, it's an unfortunate situation. But Jose Reyes, now we're just waiting on the suspension. They were waiting for the trial. They were waiting for the legal matters to get settled, and then the baseball was going to settle it and make their determination and assign some kind of suspension. That's the assumption. Now that the case has been dropped, Aroldis Chapman got 30 days. Who knows? I guess we'll find out what Jose Reyes get. At some point, Major League Baseball has to rule on this, so we probably have to hear something about this in the next couple of weeks, so I guess that'll be coming along as well. But that's what's been going on in baseball. What we're going to be talking about today, again, Jay Jaffe from SportsIllustrated.com coming on here today to talk about Major League Baseball. We're going to preview the 2016 season. And I do want to ask him a little bit about the Hall of Fame because he's so good at it. He's so reasonable and rational. He brings a historical look at things as well as an analytical approach to these things. So I like to ask him some Hall of Fame questions at least. We're not going to focus much on it, but I just want to ask him because I think in baseball or in anything, just in life in general, I don't know if we fully realize just how good we have it sometimes. We don't fully realize what we're watching while we're watching it. And Jay is a great at it when he covers the Hall of Fame, when he talks on MLB Network, or when he writes on SI.com. He brings a perspective that I like to get, because it's just a perspective I don't really have. I'm not great at connecting the history with the current, and so I want to ask him about that. But let's welcome Jay Jaffe into the program today. Jay, great to have you back on the program. Hopefully everything's going well for you. It wouldn't be Boston, it would be baseball if snow wasn't coming. I don't know where you are located, but baseball starts Sunday, and I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm in Brooklyn here, and I'm excited too. It's always a thrill to open a new season where I get to cover baseball. So you know, that's just something to be very happy about. In addition to just you know, getting the games back.
So you're in Brooklyn, and baseball starting up on Sunday. To me, the best day is Monday. Now they've expanded baseball on Sunday. It used to be just one night game, which is great. Just, you know, the sort of like lighting off the fireworks. There'd be one game, everyone get a peek at it, and then Monday the marathon really starts. This year they're going to have three games on Sunday. But for me, 1 o'clock Eastern time until about 1 a.m. Eastern time, there's nothing but baseball. I just sit there like a sloth watching all the games. I love Monday. But real quick, you're in Brooklyn. Are you feeling the burn over there? You've got politics coming up over there as well. Are you feeling the burn there in Brooklyn?
You know, there's plenty of political stuff here, but I don't really need to talk about that right now. So there's enough going on with baseball to take my attention away from the politics, at least for a short amount of time.
I don't blame you one bit. I didn't plan to get into a political discussion. It's just when I hear Brooklyn, for some reason recently, I feel Bernie Sanders, but we don't talk politics on this program other than the occasional quip. And we are going to preview 2016. But as far as what you're doing over there at SI.com, what kind of content are the men and women over there providing us these days? What are you guys covering on SI.com right now?
Well, we've got a slew of preview things up. We previewed all 30 teams. We talked to some scouts. We looked at some of the big questions that each team is facing. Myself, I looked at five Rookie of the Year candidates in each league. I looked at some of the biggest likelihoods for busts in each league, just all kinds of stuff like that here. We've got most of the magazine features, which my wife, Emma Spann, edited, are now online. Some great feature stories on Jake Arrieta, Ray Searidge, Rusty Koontz, and I'm trying to think who else. Just a lot of really good stuff. All of our scout conversations from our preview are up in a couple files. All of Joe Sheehan's how this team can win the World Series features are up as well. Just a complete overload of content here, and I'm proud to be part of it.
I can't talk highly enough about Ray Searidge. I can't say that I know him. I've never spoken with him, and I can't even say I know him in depth at all. But it just amazes me what he's able to do either guys that have never been, or guys you never thought would be, or guys that were, he saves their careers. I mean, all the mediocre pitchers that he's turned into something special in there in Pittsburgh. What? Just give us a little bit about that. I wasn't planning on talking about that, but since you mentioned it, give me a little bit of insight into Ray Searage, because it just – is it him, or it just amazes me how good a job that I think he's doing in Pittsburgh. I'm glad that you have that content up there, because I haven't read it yet, but I'm running over there as soon as I can.
Yeah, it's a neat little feature here. I mean, you know, what are the keys to the Pirates' turnaround, making the wild card NL wild card appearance in each of the last 3 years, has been their ability to get value out of these pitchers that are cast-offs from other organizations. AJ Burnett, notably, was one of them. Francisco Liriano. Let's see, who else here? We got
Jay Happ,
who went and signed a nice deal with the Blue Jays this past winter. Now they're going to try to get value out of Juan Nicasio, Ryan Vogelsong. Those are two of their projects, and John Neese as well. So really a very interesting. I mean, what Searage has done mostly is he tries to simplify things for these pitchers, tries to get their momentum going more towards home plate, cleaning up their deliveries in order to eliminate some of the extraneous stuff. Also a big emphasis on two-seam fastballs and keeping the ball on the ground. The Pirates are kind of towards the cutting edge of this trend towards defensive shifting, and they've done very well with it. So you know, if you can generate ground balls and play into good defensive alignments, then you're going to have success more often than not, and that's been a key factor for those pitchers in particular.
Yeah, I mean, he did some good things with, like, a Jeff Locke. I mean, he didn't have great years, but he had some great stretches. Charlie Morton had some success over there. It just seems like anything he – in one of my articles I wrote recently over at minorleagueball.com, I mentioned that he has the Midas touch, and it really seems like anybody that goes into his atmosphere somehow comes up succeeding to some degree or another in some form or another too as well. I'm really impressed.
Yeah, this is going to be a really interesting test this year because of the high volume of pitchers that he's got, those three that I just pointed out here, of which it looks like probably two are going to be in the rotation at any given time unless they get more contributions from down on the farm from guys like Tyler Glasnow and Jameson Taillon, who, you know, are still have some work to do. Taillon really hasn't come all the way back from Tommy John surgery yet.
Yeah, I follow prospects quite a bit, and I've had some concerns about Tyler Glasnow because he's had command issues. He's impossible to hit, so he's phenomenally talented, and guys just can't make hard contact often. But he's got a command issues. But when you've got a guy like that there, I'm fascinated to see how good he can turn him into. Because for a while there was concerns he might be a reliever because the command just wasn't there. It's been getting better, and I'm fascinated to see how well he can turn Glasnow around and maybe make him, you know, an ace like Gerrit Cole looks like he's going to be.
Yep, certainly something to watch for, and I think it might be a case where they might be better off promoting him and getting him to work with Searage on a regular basis here at some point, but they're not there yet.
Yeah. Real quickly, I want to step back, because again, I love talking Hall of Fame with you. I don't want to talk about it a lot. It's not the focus. I do want to talk about 2016 with you, cause especially when you did all those reviews. But I want to ask you about just when we're looking at what is going on. I mentioned it in the intro. I don't think we fully appreciate just how good Mike Trout is, for example, just how good he has started, or just how phenomenally good Bryce Harper was last season. Just looking real quick, because you have the perspective here, and I'm putting you in a tough spot. I apologize, but I like it because I have no doubt that you're going to be able to get out of it. How many guys are we looking at right now that are well on their way to being Hall of Famers, or you think are pretty close to already being there? How many of those guys are we seeing in the league right now?
There's different tiers. I mean, it's Mike Trout and Bryce Harper are on one tier that they've gotten off to great starts, but they're really still in their early 20s. They've just banked a few Hall of Fame caliber seasons, put themselves in conversations where the only comparables are guys like Ted Williams and Ty Cobb and, Joe DiMaggio and other, you know, young stars like that. Then you've got the next level. You've got Clayton Kershaw with his three Cy Youngs. There's nobody with three Cy Youngs who's not in the Hall of Fame. But there's longevity factors that he's still got to hurdle over in order to get there. There are some two-time Cy Young winners who are outside the Hall of Fame, like Brett Saberhagen and eventually Johan Santana, guys who just didn't hold up. And then you've got guys who are really on that last mile. Adrian Beltre is going to get to 3,000 hits, taking away what was probably going to be a relatively interesting debate and making it an automatic. You know, I would say Alex Rodriguez is a guy for whom there's almost no hope until the voters show a willingness to vote in other PED guys. Robinson Cano is a guy who's probably bound there, assuming he doesn't completely collapse in Seattle, because he's on a course to wind up with about 3,000 hits. Let's see, who else? Carlos Beltran has a shot, but if you look at the way that recent center fielders like Jim Edmonds and Kenny Lofton have been treated, that's going to be a tough haul. You know, Andrew Jones is going to hit the ballot in 2018. He's another one who could struggle. Let's see, who else have we got here?
Can you make the Sandy Koufax argument for Kershaw? I mean, assuming he throws a few more years, can you make the argument that he was so good when he was good?
Yes, but he's got to get to that. He's got to get to those 10 years at the very least. But I think, I think he's going to. I don't see any reason why that's not at least somewhat achievable. Barring complete and total catastrophe, which let's not even contemplate that.
How good is Clayton Kershaw? When you compare him to some of the greats of the greats, and again, assuming he puts in the longevity and he's dominant for a long period of time, just how amazing has Kershaw been so far?
Oh, I mean, it's been remarkable. I mean, I think inning for inning, I'd have to look, but inning for inning, we're talking about a guy who's, on a level that maybe, very few pitchers have ever been on. Pedro Martinez comes to mind in terms of total dominance. But from a left-hander, I mean, it's a bit of a different story here. I mean, it is, if you adjust for era and for ballpark and for scoring level, I mean, it's perhaps more impressive than Koufax, except you don't have the postseason stuff, where Koufax really did separate himself from some of the pack there. So remarkable start to his career, and you just hope it continues and that he stays healthy. Mm-hmm.
All right, let's get back into 2016. I'd just like to get your thoughts on it, because, again, I think everyone realizes that we're dealing with quite a good pitcher in Clayton Kershaw, but one of the best ever, having one of the best careers ever. I don't know if people fully realize those kinds of things. That's why I wanted to ask your perspective on that.
Sure.
I realize I went off topic just a little bit there, but I like getting your insights while I've got you trapped here under my podcast wing here.
Let's put it this way. Clayton Kershaw already has a Hall of Fame caliber peak under his belt here, pretty much. He's just got to round out the career here.
And transitioning back into 2016, I recently wrote an article about how many good young shortstops are coming up through the minor leagues right now. And it's a little bit different. I remember when I was kind of growing up and really starting to enjoy baseball, we had guys like Garcia Parra and Derek Jeter and Miguel Tejada and a young A-Rod. These guys could hit for power. Derek Jeter never hit for a lot of power, but Garcia Parra could hit for batting titles and things like that. That was my heyday of the shortstop. These shortstops coming up through the system now, they can do a little bit of everything, and it's really going from what I thought of as sort of a thin position to now there's a lot of really pretty good shortstops coming up through the minor leagues. Whereas, again, like I said before, I thought the shortstop position was a little bit thin. I think third base is a little bit thin at the major league level. I'm curious of your thoughts. Where are the strengths and the weaknesses positionally in Major League Baseball right now, in your opinion?
Well, I think, shortstop did stand out as one, but, the arrivals of Carlos Correa and Francisco Lindor, I think, have changed that. I'm not sure I noticed any others that are maybe particularly glaring. I mean, we've lost the full-time DHs for the most part, besides David Ortiz, but I don't think that's something we should really lament too much. It does seem like we may be in a bit of a lull with regards to good two-way catchers. I think we've, Brian McCann's decline, Yadier Molina's decline. I don't think we're seeing the MVP caliber catchers that we've seen in just a few years ago, when McCann and Jonathan Lucroy, another one who seems to be on a downward trajectory. It's just tough to hold up at that position. Yan Gomes, a guy who had a really nice year a couple seasons ago, got hurt last year and was terrible. So I think we may be at a bit of a low, but it's big picture. I don't know that that's really much more than a 1 or 2 year fluctuation here. So I don't want to get too alarmed. But for a while, it seemed like shortstop, there were really a dearth of them, a dearth of good young ones around. But like you said, I mean, there's good ones on the way as well as good ones that just got here.
And I think a lot of it, I don't think it's a bad thing if they do transition to defensive catchers being more of the norm, and the fact that they can't hit necessarily, that might not be a bad thing. And when you're looking at things, advanced metrics like WAR, you may be better off with like a Christian Vasquez in Boston, who really can't hit very much, but it could be if he, assuming he recovers from Tommy John surgery, which is strange. A Tommy John surgery for a field player, it shouldn't be strange. I mean, a catcher throws the ball as much, if not more, than a pitcher. So Tommy John shouldn't be shocking, but nonetheless, he's going to have to recover from that. But it's not a bad thing if you've got an elite defender as opposed to a guy who can't really hit as far as WAR goes these days. But let me ask you about that, because you're very much in it. When I see you on MLB Network and some of your writings, you definitely look at things from an advanced metrics perspective. And one of my problems with it, I love the way Brian Kenny talks about it, which is it's a guide, but you shouldn't take it as the Bible when it comes to advanced metrics. There are limitations and gray areas and so forth, in my opinion. And I just have a hard time with the defensive metrics being accurate and how so many players get so much value, I think, tied to the defensive metrics. I'm curious, how accurate and how comfortable do you feel with the WAR stat and in general looking at a player's value because with so much weight on defense? Because if we're going to have catchers who can't hit at all, then if that's going to be worth it, if you're going to say, okay, we're going to go with a defense-only guy, then those metrics have to be accurate, and I don't know how comfortable I feel with it. How comfortable do you feel with where defensive metrics are right now, at least in the game?
Well, I don't think they're ideal, but I think you get in the habit of consulting multiple metrics for a single year and consulting multiple years of like metrics. I think you get more comfortable with it. I mean, I don't think you lose too much sleep if one metric is saying this guy went from +5 last year to -5 this year. If that information is contradicted elsewhere, you want to take that into account and think, maybe that's not as bad as it looks here. A guy I'm thinking of, Howie Kendrick, big drop off last year from the Dodgers, although from his 2014 with the Angels, although it's not as bad if you look at, say, ultimate zone rating versus if you look at defensive runs saved. I do think it's important to think about those things, though, and to think about them in the larger context of multiple seasons. But I think you also need to remember, age especially, that you maybe need to be more sensitive to a one-year fluctuation, because otherwise, if you're a team investing too much money or putting too much stock in, let's say a middle infielder on the wrong side of 30, 32, you need to take those fluctuations a little bit more seriously, which is why I thought that the Dodgers re-signing Howie Kendrick was maybe a bit misguided. I'm very interested in the catching stats. I do think that, with framing becoming something that's more widely known, that a lot of the value has been squeezed out of that, in the same way that, an on-base percentage was kind of the A's secret recipe back in the so-called Moneyball era, and then was widely noticed by more teams. That particular value was kind of neutralized. So there's a danger of that, and there's maybe a little bit more, there's some learning on the part of umpires as well in terms of noting which catchers are best at stealing strikes, and maybe they're trying to compensate for that a little bit, working on their own techniques when it comes to calling games, and maybe the outliers are disappearing there. But, for the most part, I think I'm pretty comfortable using WAR and using defensive data as part of that. I think you just have to remember that there's much more certainty with offensive data than there is with defensive data. You still have, to me, the big thing beyond what an individual metric is telling you is to just remember positional scarcity in the defensive spectrum and just how much more important it is. When you've got offensive production from a defense-first position like shortstop, center field, and catcher, the big ones there, and then just how much more valuable those players are when they can hold up both sides of that equation.
Yeah, and I do want to get into Rookie of the Year, things like you said you wrote about over at SI.com. And being a Boston guy, I'm going to be a little bit selfish. I don't know if Blake Swihart, maybe he doesn't qualify as a rookie anymore. I don't know the exact numbers, but I don't see a lot of respect out there for him, and I see his all-around game. I really like what he provides on the field. I'm curious, do you have an opinion about Blake Swihart? Because it seems like he's at least a decent defender, and it looks like he could be a above-average offensive player, and yet I'm not hearing people talk about him as, a future star. Maybe it's because catchers, chicks dig the long ball, but they don't necessarily care that much about catchers. I don't know. But I'm just curious, what do you think about Blake Swihart, and how does he rate compared to other catchers?
Well, first of all, Swihart's not a rookie. He had 309 plate appearances last year, 288 at-bats. The cutoff for at-bats is 130, so he's no longer a rookie. You know, he had a solid rookie season. You know, I think his strikeout to walk ratio concerns me though. 18 walks, 77 strikeouts in those 309 plate appearances. That's not great. Defensively, he was pretty solid. I don't know what his framing numbers were. I'd have to pull those up here on the fly to give you an evaluation here. But I thought he did a pretty decent job, you know, in filling in when Vasquez went down. A little aside on the Tommy John surgery stuff. When Matt Wieters had his Tommy John surgery, I looked into the history of it among catchers. It's grim. There are not many catchers who've even come back to be. To do what Wieters did last year. The number of success stories is vanishingly small. So, you know, I think the Red Sox and people who are watching them really need to have some patience with, you know, with how quickly he gets back to, you know, being what he's being. I mean, this is a guy who is already supposed to be, you know, a standout defender, but not necessarily a top-notch hitter. And I think with the Red Sox, they've got a nice tandem there of two guys who are maybe you know, young and have some opportunity to develop some, you know, a bit more offensively, but really don't project to be much more than average offensive contributions from catchers. I think anything they give you beyond that is going to be a bonus. So, you know, they're interesting young players. I think at some point, if Vasquez ever proves he's fully healthy again, maybe you consider trading Swihart for something to fill another need. But, you know, I think he's a competent catcher. I don't know that I see a future star there though.
Yeah, it's a tough position to have a star. I mean, if there is one position where there's a weakness in the league, I think it probably is catcher. It's tough to be an elite defender, and it seems like there's almost nobody that can actually hit. So it's definitely a tough position to find somebody who stands out, never mind is special. It's a tough spot.
Yeah, and, you know, I think maybe the framing stuff has brought back just an appreciation for the fact that the defense is so valuable. I mean, when you look at when you look at traditional WAR, it seems like, you know, because catchers play about 20% less, even the full-timers play about 20% less than your average position player, that they don't deliver as much value. Well, all that value comes back in the form of pitch framing and the degree of difference or the variance from the best to the worst is pretty big, and that has to be factored into any kind of evaluation when you're comparing them. So looking up Swihart here, he was about 6 runs below average last year on the framing. That's not great. It's not going to kill you. Obviously, you'd like to see that improve here. And as minor league numbers suggest, he can be better than that. So it'll be interesting to see just how he develops.
And I think he was rushed a little bit. If Vasquez didn't get hurt and things like that, I don't think Swihart would have gotten
many
at bat. So
no doubt.
So last year was a little bit of a rush, and therefore maybe he struggled a little bit. He was over his head at first, and started to maybe improve as the season went along. So let me ask you about pitch framing, because if I was to tell my father, you know, this guy's a good pitch framer, I don't think my father would be overly impressed or think that it mattered all that much. But what is the actual impact, in your opinion, of what pitch framing is? Is it essential? Is it a huge impact on value and on WAR and things like that? How important is pitch framing?
I mean, you're talking about there's generally about a 30 to 40 run difference between the very best and the very worst, you know, in some seasons. That's pretty substantial. That's about 3 wins difference right there. That's not including throwing out base stealers. You know, you can't really quantify the other stuff as far as the game calling ability, but this falls in there. And I think people get, you know, what the average viewer, when they're watching the game and they're just enraged because it feels like their team isn't getting the calls on the borderline of the strike zone. Well, you know why? That's because you've got a good pitch framer back there. More often than not, you've got a guy who knows what he's doing, knows how to steal those strikes on the edges, particularly in the key moments. And it'll drive you nuts if you're not aware of it. You go back to those Braves teams that Tom Glavine and Greg Maddux had some success with. Well, they probably had some pretty good pitch framers back there. Unfortunately, we don't have the same level of data that we do now in the pitch FX era, but no doubt those guys had some help from guys like Javi Lopez behind the plate.
And who are the best and who are the worst pitch framers in the game right now?
Let's see here. I'd have to go back and look at the stats again, but you know, I know one who stands out as the worst, and I just cannot for the life of me figure out why he keeps getting the love that he does, at least from his team, is Kurt Suzuki. I thought when the Twins traded for John Ryan Murphy that was going to be a changing of the guard thing here, but that didn't happen. Yasmani Grandal was I think the most effective last year according to Baseball Prospectus's numbers. Francisco Cervelli was one who was very, very good. The Yankees have done a great job of developing good pitch framers. They were silly though when they didn't keep Russell Martin. The Pirates were another team that was again ahead of the curve when it came to recognizing the value of pitch framing. You look at the catchers that have changed teams between those two sides over the last few years. They're all good pitch framers. Even backup Chris Stewart, Yadi Molina, generally a good pitch framer. Brother Jose, now gone from Major League Baseball, an even better pitch framer. But those Molinos, definitely good at it. Russell Martin, as I said, very good at it. Travis d'Arnaud, very good at it. Buster Posey, very good at it. Miguel Montero. One who stands out in particular as not being particularly good at it is Sal Perez. But I know that the Royals pitchers really love him nonetheless, and they certainly play the hell out of him. So I wonder about his long-term prospects, and you know, particularly in light of that new extension that he got. But whatever value he's got, some of it's offset a bit by that pitch framing stuff, because he just generally comes out as one of the less impressive ones.
What are your thoughts on that, Sal Perez, since you mentioned it? Do you think a team should rip up a contract and give a guy a new one? I mean, they took a chance on him. They gave him a contract extremely early on. Obviously, it turned out to be a highway robbery type of deal. But do you feel like the team should have done that? And team chemistry, I think, is a thing, but it's hard to quantify. But do you think they really had to tear that up and give him a new one? Was that the right move, or do you think
They didn't have to, but I don't think it was a bad thing because look, this is a guy who's probably not going to have a huge career after that contract is up. They are squeezing about as much value from him as he's going to produce at the major league level at the rate that they're wearing through him. So, you know, I think in good conscience, it's a contract that makes sense. That said, I mean, he signed it, his agent okayed it, this deal. He's lucky that he's got a team that values him so highly. But then, you know, that's when you produce the way he has and help the team do a couple world championships a couple World Series appearances and a championship and a regarded that favorably among the coaching staff and among the pitching staff, you're going to get rewarded for it. So, you know, good on him. I don't begrudge any player that kind of money.
Yeah, I don't mind them being, giving in a little bit. My problem is the other way around. I think the players' union, a guy like a Pablo Sandoval, when you sign a player and you give him big money, you're essentially giving it to him for what he's already done and hoping that he'll do some of that in the future. But I think the player owes something to the organization to at least be dedicated to his job. And when you've got a guy like Pablo Sandoval, from all reports that he has shown no dedication and no effort to kind of show that he's dedicated and committed to that contract, it seems like the organization should have something to say about that. I mean, Pablo Sandoval shows up grossly overweight. He can't play anymore, essentially. He really can't play anymore, and there's nothing you can do about it. To me, that seems wrong.
Well, they've done something about it. They've benched him. That's something to do about it. I mean, they're not without leverage. They basically publicly humiliated him. Look, I think that Sandoval is, that he has screwed up big time. I think that anybody looking at when he signed that deal a couple years ago could have said this is a disaster waiting to happen if he doesn't stay in shape here. That obviously we all know that picture that came out in mid-February here after he reported to camp. He looked terrible. But that, you know, back then you had Dave Dombrowski and other people in the organization saying that they were pleased with the amount of work that he put in this offseason. So they were covering for him there for a while. Now they've used the only recourse they have, which is to bench him, and basically, you know, I saw the research from Alex Speer, the great Boston Globe writer, that nobody in the last at least the last 5 or 6 years has signed a deal that big and that long and lost their job that quickly. Not Melvin Upton, not anybody else here. But his went south very quickly, and that's a problem for him. It's an even bigger problem for the Red Sox, though, because they can't seem to resist these big deals. They got themselves in a lot of trouble there, and it cost Ben Cherington his job. They got bailed out once by the Dodgers in that 2012 trade that sent Carl Crawford and Adrian Gonzalez and Josh Beckett away. But they've repeated those mistakes with Sandoval, Ramirez, and Rusny Castillo, and it's just turned out disastrously, which is why Sherrington's not around anymore and why they've gone to the Dave Dombrowski regime. So, you know, it's look, players crashing on – free agents crashing on big contracts is nothing new. A team has to be selective about when they dish them out and to whom they dish them out, and making sure that the guys that they're dishing them out to are the guys that they think have the work ethic in order to withstand the ups and downs that that can come with aging. And I think if you looked at Hanley Ramirez, if you looked at Pablo Sandoval, there have been big red flags there. So that's on them as much as it's on the player.
No, I have no sympathy for that. I'm a little less critical.
Let me just insert one other thing here.
Okay.
I have to think, and I will not put myself in the head of any player. I think that's a very dangerous place to be, but I do have to wonder what's going on, you know, beyond the baseball stuff. What's going on with Pablo Sandoval? Are there matters there that need attention? And I think if there are, or whether or not there are, it's in the Red Sox best interest to see that those are addressed, because there may be some more deep seated issues there that, you know, are not just going to be taken care of by, you've got to lose 25 pounds and show up to camp and win your third base job or whatever. So, you know, I think this, like, you know, this, and I know that the Red Sox are trying to do more with the psychological side of things than some teams. So I'd be very interested to know if they are doing anything on that front, because I don't think you're going to get anything out of Pablo Sandoval without addressing some of that stuff, obviously in confidentiality behind the scenes, to an extent that probably the average fan doesn't need to know, but it does need to be addressed.
Yeah, and the Red Sox, as great a job as Theo Epstein did here and as good a job as Ben Chiarang did as far as developing the minor league system, all of those, going all the way back to Theo, they've always been bad at signing free agents. I mean, they lucked out really with David Ortiz. They deserve credit for grabbing David Ortiz, but I'm not so sure you'd say they knew they had a potential Hall of Famer when the Twins let him go. I mean, David Ortiz was not a Hall of Famer when he left Minnesota. I'm not so sure they deserve a ton of credit for. I think it was almost luck. I mean, there was some skill there, I imagine, in the scouting and the in looking at him and saying, we think we can get something from him. I don't doubt that the Red Sox did some nice things there. But when you look at all of the signings that they've done going way back, whether it's Julio Lugo or Edgar Renteria or Crawford obviously not being able to handle Boston, they've been horrible at signing free agents for a long time up here, ever since Theo took over and Ben Cherington took over from there. So it's no surprise that this happened. And Sandoval was so obvious. I don't have any sympathy for them because they basically paid him double. And that has nothing to do with whether you thought he would never – they have the problems that he's having now, and he may have off the field or some problems that need to be addressed. But they paid him double what he was worth the day it happened, regardless of all those other issues. So I have no sympathy there either. I would like to see the guy being dedicated at least. You don't pay for results. You just pay for effort and commitment. And it doesn't seem like the Pablo effort and commitment was there. And I would like to see some kind of recourse when a guy – because it seems like all he has to do is show up to the field and he gets his money. Doesn't have to do anything else. Now, maybe Pablo did put in effort, and I don't know. Maybe I'm just being overly, but it seems like he did absolutely nothing, and he just picks up his checks. And to me, that is what bothers me. Not that I'm trying to be sympathetic to the Red Sox, because I'm absolutely not, especially with Sandoval. But it just seems like certain guys, and Hanley may fit this description as well, we'll see this year. They say he's dedicated right now, but who knows? Maybe as we get into the season, he'll fall off like he did last year. It just seems like with Sandoval, at least, it seems like he truly put in no effort whatsoever to try to at least be able to play the game. And guaranteed contracts, there's no punishment for that. It seems like that's, I guess that's the one thing, the one issue I have with potentially this situation.
I don't have any issue with anybody getting a guaranteed contract. I think the Baseball Players Union, I mean, these guys, when you look at the value that these guys don't get paid for in their early years. I mean, it all balances out, but it's the teams, you know, the teams are the ones who have to make the smart decisions. Nobody held a gun to the Red Sox head and made them sign that 5-year deal. Look, I think it's understandably frustrated. I think that you're in danger of making it a personal thing, though, when it comes to this. I mean, you know, most free agents go this direction, just not to the same degree. I think if you get wrapped up in the personality stuff and take it personally, I think you're going to be an unhappy fan more often than not. And, you know, I don't know. That's just a – I say that as somebody who, you know, really has having moved into the professional realm relatively late in my professional career here with regards to having a career change around my late 30s, you know, and seeing the difference between how I approach this as a fan and how I approach this as a professional, it's a lot easier to look at it from a dispassionate point of view than it is if you're wrapped up in that, you know, particularly in one team. You know, you see all sides of things, and you realize that you know, this happens. This isn't just somebody trying to screw you and your favorite team out of something. This is something that really is just a general fact of sports and baseball and aging and money and the way the system is set up. So, you know, it's there's a lot there beyond, you know, Pablo Sandoval isn't dedicated enough, I think, or, you know, insert your whichever other player is the object of your ire at the moment there as well.
Yep, and that's fair, and I throw that caveat out there that I don't know. So if I'm wrong, I'm absolutely, you know, you got to correct your – and I definitely could be. I have no clue about whether he was dedicated in the offseason or not. So if he was and I'm wrong, absolutely I'm wrong, and I would definitely change my opinion and so forth. And I just – hopefully I am wrong. Hopefully there's a problem there that they can solve and he gets back to it, and hopefully it isn't that he was lazy and didn't do anything. I don't know, and I'm wrong, and hopefully you're right when it comes to that. But all right, let's get back to what you've been doing over at SI.com, because you've got a lot of interesting things going on right now. You talked about rookies of the year, potential busts, things like this. Let's get into those a little bit. Let's look at let's start with the rookies, the young players. They're exciting. Who are the guys that you had on your rookie of the year list, and who are the young players that you think could have a pretty big season this year?
Well, you know, this year, I mean, I think there's fewer sleepers in that when you look at the rookie of the year candidates, the top two prospects are the only two that really have pathways to jobs on opening day. That's Corey Seager and Byron Buxton. Those were my two picks for rookie of the year here. When I looked at the AL possibilities, it's like everybody else in that equation is starting the year in the minor leagues pretty much here. I'm thinking of Jose Berríos and Blake Snell, A.J. Reed of the Astros, who lost out the first base job. That to me was fairly surprising there. Who's the other one here? Hang on. Joey Gallo, another guy who's got to wait it out, and Sean Mania of the A's. The Mets, the only other out-of-the-gate rookie of the year candidate who's starting the year with his team is Steven Matz, who we saw a bit of last year and would have exhausted his rookie status had he stayed healthy last year. You know, I think that he's an interesting one. I think Orlando Arcia and Trey Turner, two other good young shortstops who are on the way, are guys who could inject themselves into that if they come up early enough. But there's no guarantee there. Likewise, Tyler Glasnow, we went over some of his issues there. I think you're right on point there in terms of it matches what I'm hearing about concerns about his command. Dodgers, you know, I mean, I think in both leagues there's a very legitimate possibility that an overaged Asian player can steal this Rookie of the Year award. I mean, I think my colleague Cliff Corcoran picked Byung-ho Park, the Twins DH, as somebody who could win that award. I'm not really sold on Park based on the scouts that I talked to, but he's you know, he's in the picture there, and you can't he's eligible to win the award. Likewise for Kenta Maeda of the Dodgers, Japanese import, of whom there are very mixed reviews from scouts, or very wide spectrum of reviews from scouts, I should say. Some people saw him and were very impressed in spring training. Others think that he just doesn't have quite the stuff to live up to the billing there, and there are some injury concerns. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if one of those guys, you know, snatched away this award. They're eligible for it, but I didn't want to pick them in this context because I wanted to focus on the really young players.
When you look at Trey Turner, from what you've been able to research and your reporting, could he be up soon? Because it seems like if he had really dominated, it seems like the players blocking him in Washington, because Washington wants to win this year. They have a competitive team, maybe the best team in the NL East. You look at the Mets rotation, and you can definitely make an argument for the Mets being better. But I think the Nationals are at least a pretty good team, and they should be a competitive team, and they have playoff aspirations here. Do you think he could be up soon, or is this a guy that you wait till like the Super 2 deadline passing? How quickly could we possibly see Trey turn up there?
My guess is that we're probably looking at a Super 2 guy here, or a Super 2 deadline guy. I think that, you know, for one thing, I know the Nationals really like Danny Espinosa and have held on to him, you know, in order to give him a shot at this, at least to this extent, whether it's to showcase him in his best light, at his best position, or just because they feel they owe him that much, having held on to him so long through injuries and all kinds of other problems. Let's remember, this is a Dusty Baker team, and Dusty Baker is, you know, at one time was notorious for the fact that he would not play rookies regularly or was a particularly tough customer when it came to breaking in rookies here. So I don't know how much of that is factoring into this. I suspect it's a little from column A, a little from column B. I do think that Turner is probably their best option, but that they want to see him get a little bit more seasoning. This is a guy who was a 2014 draft pick, and you know, it's not unreasonable for him to, you know, spend two full seasons in the minor leagues. You know, he was up late last year, so he didn't get that. For him to spend a little bit more time honing his game before they throw the spotlight on him.
And when you look at the Nationals last season, everyone thought that they were the runaway best team, maybe in all of baseball, at least one of the two or three best teams in the National League, to say the least. And obviously, while they had an okay season, they were over 500. You'd have to say it was a significantly disappointing season for a variety of reasons. There were some injuries there. But it seems like at least some of it was just hard to explain. A guy has an MVP season in Bryce Harper, and yet they end up at 83-79, I think, was their record. And it seems like team chemistry was at least suggested maybe was a problem. And it seems like Dusty Baker is thought of as being a really good chemistry guy. I don't know if that's true. I don't know how you prove that. But that's my read on what Dusty Baker does well, because he does get criticized for his X's and O's quite a bit. I'm just curious, what do you think Dusty Baker brings to the Nationals? And are the Nationals better this year with a different roster and an entirely new manager that – I would have to assume has a pretty significantly different approach than what they had last year with Matt Williams?
Well, I think Dusty Baker is definitely a different voice. I think obviously it was clear that they tired of Matt Williams' voice and that he lost the clubhouse at some point last year, as that infamous quote from Jason Worth shows. But I mean, I think the biggest problem with the Nationals last year was injuries. So look at the amount of time that Worth, Anthony Rendon, who was MVP caliber in 2014, you know, look at the time those two guys missed. Denard Span missed a ton of time. Ryan Zimmerman missed a ton of time. I mean, those are some of their top older players, and you know, they were the team leaders as well as being some of their top players this side of Bryce Harper. And they didn't deliver because of injuries and ineffectiveness there. Ian Desmond was just downright terrible at the plate and was really pressing for a lot of the year. I mean, you know, so there were a lot of things that went into creating that bad chemistry mix, and a lot, you know, some of those players are gone. I think just the fact that Dusty Baker is a different voice and it's a slightly different cast of characters will help. That said, I thought that the Nationals had a very poor winter, and now we know why, because they're reluctant to spend money because of this regional network dispute that they're involved in the Orioles, of which I'm not exactly clear on the specifics of it, but I know that a lot of the money that they were offering was deferred money to guys like Yoenis Cespedes and some of the other big free agents that they were in on, which is why they didn't land anybody besides Danny Murphy there in terms of the guys that they sought. There are bigger organizational issues beyond just Dusty Baker there. I do think that this is a team that, you know, is capable of being a playoff team if things break right, but you know, I think at the same time, I don't see a rotation that's nearly as strong as that of the Mets right now, and the Mets did a nice job of shoring up their lineup from day one here, so they're not going to need the same kind of midseason overhauls they got last year. So, you know, this is a case where, and I say this as somebody who picked the Nationals to win last year, to win it all. They've got a lot to prove right now, and I'm going to be behind the curve the next time they win something by not picking them until they show that they can actually turn those individual talents into a great team.
How good do you think the Mets are? Because they were, I think, the fifth best team in baseball last year as far as earned runs allowed, which means that even if they pitch as well as they did last year, and they probably will pitch as well, if not better. But how much better did their offense get? So, because if they're going to continue and win 90 games again, or even do better and legitimately be another World Series possible contender, where they probably have the most room to get better is on offense. their pitching could get significantly better and maybe not even win them any games over what they did last year. So it seems like offense is where they need to get it in order to really either maintain or get better. That's my read on it. Anyway, what do you
think?
I'm thinking this to drop off.
Well, I think the offense is actually much improved. I mean, I think even if you don't get as much out of David Wright as you did last year, even if you don't get as much out of David Wright as you had in years past, you will get more out of him than last year. Likewise for Travis d'Arnaud, those are plus offensive players. I think Asdrubal Cabrera and Neil Walker are upgrades as well. A full season of Yoenis Cespedes and Michael Conforto is an upgrade. I think that there's a lot to be optimistic about with regards to the Mets as having a better offense. Just by the fact that you've got Wilmer Flores as a bench piece now instead of Eric Campbell is huge. I mean, this is these are the types of things that they've strengthened that roster, not just among the starters, but on the bench there. I mean, obviously, they don't have Juan Uribe and Kelly Johnson coming off the bench, and that was a big deal for them down the stretch last year. But, you know, they've got a lot of fortifications here, and I think they're going to be just fine. I see them as, winning somewhere between 90 and 95 games and being a team that can challenge for the pennant. I have the Cubs ahead of them, in terms of winning the pennant, but I would not be at all surprised if the Mets are back in the World Series just on the strength of that staff and those upgrades.
The one thing I look at with the Mets, and I agree with you that their offense should be better, there's some ifs and questions about how much better. In my mind, you make a good case for why it could be significantly better, but I don't know if we absolutely know that they will, but I definitely think that you're right in that. That they could. There's definitely room for those guys to be much better than what they had there last year. But when I look at it, I see Conforto in left and Cespedes in right. I don't think Cespedes can play center field full time 130 games, or I don't think you're going to love what you're getting there. And
no.
It sounds like the way they're going to solve that or minimize that is that Conforto might end up sitting. Now, Conforto looks like a really good player. It seems like you want him in there 130 times, but if you want to avoid Cespedes in center 130 times, it looks like Conforto's the guy that has to lose at bats in order to do that. How do you think the Mets should handle it, and how do you think the Mets are going to handle it to maximize two good players that should be in the lineup, but it looks like it's going to be difficult to find ways to get them both in there 135 times a year, which is ideally what you'd probably want, right?
Well, I think that we saw that last year. I think that we saw what's going to happen and what's going to continue to happen is that you're going to see Cespedes start in center field and maybe play six innings there. Conforto as a lefty is a guy who's going to be shielded from most lefties. So you can give Cespedes starts in left field and put Juan Lagares in center field on those days. I think otherwise you've got, Lagares coming in as a defensive replacement and shifting Cespedes over to left field late in games. I think that's going to be the way that most of this works. And yes, it will cost Conforto some at-bats. A lot of those at-bats would come against lefties, and you're maybe, stunting his development a little bit there. But, I think in the grand scheme of things, it's not a huge deal. You can also, bump Curtis Granderson to the bench at some points as well if you want to try Cespedes in right field, which is I don't think he's played at the major league level, but I certainly don't see why he wouldn't be capable of it. He's got the arm for it. We know that. I think that there are ways to get around this. It's not entirely optimal, but it's also probably a short-term thing because I think in all likelihood Cespedes is going to opt out after this year and try to come up with another long-term deal, assuming he doesn't completely crater.
We're talking Major League Baseball 2016 preview with Jay Jaffe from SI.com. If you want to follow him on Twitter, it's @J_Jaffe, J-A-F-F-E. Let's talk about your busts and your breakouts. Who are your busts, potential busts, and who are your potential breakouts?
Oh, let's see here. Who did I have for busts? Let me see here. I mean, some of the guys, I didn't want to pick on guys who were already below replacement level last year, which is why I left Pablo Sandoval and Hanley Ramirez out of there. The headline grabber, I think, is Yadier Molina, a guy who did crash last year but was still pretty valuable. I'm worried about that thumb injury. He's had three thumb surgeries on his two thumbs over the last 2 years, two this winter, one to repair, the second one to reconstruct it when the first one didn't take. And his offense is falling through the floor and as he's aging. I just don't think he's going to be a great two-way contributor anymore. I do worry about Howie Kendrick, as noticed. I thought that was not a great deal. I think his defense has slipped. Asdrubal Cabrera, I'm not particularly sold on, although that said, he is an upgrade on Wilmer Flores and Ruben Tejada. Ben Revere, I don't see being as nearly as good as Denard Span was for the Nationals. James Shields, I just don't see him getting back to where he was a few years ago, even in Petco Park. You know, I think there's some weird home run stuff going on there that really doesn't favor a guy who gives up as many fly balls as he does. And then in the American League, I've got Nick Castellanos, Tigers third baseman, who really has just never been able to field the position adequately. Giovanni Gallardo, I think, it was a bad move by the Orioles, I think, in light of his shoulder problems and his plummeting strikeout rate and diminished stamina. Ian Kennedy, I do not for the life of me think that he was worth a five-year deal, although I can at least appreciate what the Royals are thinking by moving him to a more pitcher-friendly park, yes, even more pitcher-friendly than Petco, and putting a much better defense behind him than he had in San Diego. Lorenzo Cain versus Will Myers in center field, I think that says it all. Kurt Suzuki, another guy who I just don't see why he persists. I know that the Twins pitchers love him, so I guess that explains that, and the managers love him. So I understand that, but statistically, on either side of the ball, there's just no way you can get, you can't get a better catcher out of John Ryan Murphy, I don't think. So those are some of my busts. As to my breakouts, geez. Breakouts.
Tristan Cookcroft is a fantasy writer, but he made a comment that he thinks Mookie Betts is going to be the surprise AL MVP. That's a pretty aggressive statement.
And yeah.
What do you think about Mookie Betts? How good can he be, and can he actually be that good? I mean, I like Mookie Betts. I'm a Red Sox guy, so I love Mookie Betts. But AL MVP, that's probably going out.
Yeah,
I
think it's an outside shot for Mookie Betts to be an MVP candidate right now. But I guess I could see the logic there of somebody choosing him. I think he could be the best player on the Red Sox, though. I think that's well within his range. My AL breakouts: Aaron Sanchez and Marcus Stroman for the Blue Jays. I mean, obviously, we've been hearing about these guys for years now, but they've only got a combined 35 starts under their belt. Those are two who I see as being potential breakouts. I also like some of the ones that my colleagues at SI Tab, Jonathan Scope of the Orioles, who's got big power and good defensive ability in second base. Rougned Odor, one of my favorite young players to watch.
Gotta love the name.
What's that? Oh yeah, love.
Gotta love the name.
Yeah, I love Rougie. Those are ones that come to mind there. Also, another one to keep in mind as far as getting back to the Searidge story is Juan Nicasio, who I thought the Dodgers were insane to non-tender, and I just don't see why they let him go. And it looks like he's made the rotation in Pittsburgh. And it's just another case of Searidge straightening out a guy's mechanics here, and I think that's going to be a very interesting one to watch. Let's see. That's about it. I think that's a pretty good selection there.
Where are you standing on Jason Hayward? You're an advanced metrics guy. When you got like a Chris Russo over at MLB Network who just can't believe that Hayward got that kind of money. Then you've got some people, I don't know if it was Keith Law, but you've got some advanced metric guys who actually think that not only did Hayward deserve the money, that it was probably a bargain. I've heard some people try to go that far that way. Where's your read on how much money Hayward got? I realize age matters. You're obviously going to get longer and more money when you're younger. To me, that's where a lot of Hayward's money came from, was they still see upside in him. I'm curious, what's your thoughts on Hayward and the huge contract that he got and the kind of player that he is and how advanced metrics plays into how you value a guy like Hayward? What's your thoughts on him?
Well, I can see why people would believe he's worth more money. When you look at so much of his value is tied up in that defense and an extra 10 to 15 runs a year above average there that doesn't show up to somebody who's just looking at those, you know, nice on base percentage, but I would say, you know, mid-level power there, may not think he's actually worth that. The question is the extent to which defensive skill ages well, and how well it survives a move from ballpark to ballpark. I think we got a little bit of an answer in terms of the ballpark to ballpark stuff, because he did well in St. Louis as well as his time in Atlanta. But you know, as your neighbors change around you, at any position, that can skew your metrics, which is why you want to look at multiple years there. you know, I think that there's an argument to be made that maybe he could have gotten even more money if you plug him into we have what's called a what is he really worth series at SI.com, where we use the marginal cost of a win, inflation rate, and a very simple, you know, kind of Marcel-based projection, which weights the player's last 3 years and attaches it to an aging curve, just in terms of the kind of research that's done at places like FanGraphs, and you get a rough estimate for what this guy could be worth, and you can bracket that by changing your assumptions to see, you know, what the low end and high end estimates should be. We ran that, you know, you can get estimates that say Hayward's worth $300 million over the next 10 years. You know, that sounds very high. Obviously, it is very high. I think you want to back off of that. But let's remember that this is a guy who's got opt out clauses in there, so the chances that this matters all that much are maybe overstated when it comes to the big picture stuff, because most guys who have an opt-out clause do exercise it and do wind up getting more money, for better or for worse.
And I was talking with Rob Nyer a few weeks ago, and we revolved around the Red Sox and the perception that the media can create or the fans get kind of pushed into, I guess is one way I'd put it. And I was talking about the Red Sox as an example. I use them a lot because I'm from Boston. And the Red Sox, after they signed Hanley Ramirez and Pablo Sandoval last year, people thought, wow, this is a great offense. They have a chance to be competitive in the AL East. Everybody admitted that their staff wasn't great, but they still thought they could be competitive in the East and maybe even win the division. I looked at that staff, and a lot of the projections had that. You go to BP or you go over to FanGraphs, and a lot of them projected the Red Sox to be at least a good team, not a great team, but anywhere from 87 to, you know, 92 wins, which it would be in contention for the division. And I was just eyeballing it. I wasn't doing the numbers or the advanced look. I was just saying, a team whose best pitchers are Clay Buchholz and Porcello cannot win 90 games and cannot win a division. He pointed out that, what are you going to do, eyeball it? You got to look at the numbers, you got to look at the projections, and you got to go with that. But you look at it and you say, Hayward could be worth $300 million. There is no way he's going to get $300 million, but you can do projections or that can justify that. For the average fan, how do you explain when people put together numbers and projections and say he's worth $300 million and this is why, he gets under $200 million, and the average fan probably, again, they don't know everything. They don't know all the numbers. They don't project the defensive metrics like people who are looking at the numbers do. But I would be surprised if the average fan thinks that Hayward is worth even $130 million. How do you make a persuasive argument that a player who the average fan maybe thinks is worth $130 million and a stats guy can tell you how he's worth $300 million? How do you resolve that just enormous gap in differing views on just one player, never mind all players?
Well, it isn't easy. But I think the first thing, the big fundamental thing is that I think fans don't really have a great understanding of the difference between what a player is worth once he reaches free agency versus what he's worth in his first 3 years, his pre-arb years, and what he's worth in his arbitration years, and how that's fractional relative to what he's worth on the open market, which is why you get the sticker shock. Because, you know, for the first 3 years of a guy's career, he is earning some function, you know, that's somewhere between $500,000 and $600,000, which, you know, for most of us is already dream money relative to what we're making. And then, you know, after that, he's making, you know, a few million dollars a year, a few million more dollars a year, you know, maybe up to, you know, almost, you know, an eight-figure sum there by the time he's on the verge of free agency. And then he can sign a contract that may double even that. And suddenly you're in the stratosphere there, and you're talking about guys who are pulling down nine-figure deals, which are going to set up they and their progeny for, you know, for life. So, you know, I think it's tough to reconcile that with the fact that players are so underpaid during their early years, and that we're seeing more and more of those players deliver a higher percentage of major league value during those first 3 to 6 years. So that is a crucial part of the equation that I don't think the average fan understands. The second thing is that one of the reasons why the cost of a win is so inflated on the free agent market is because these players don't deliver all that much value. You know, they tend to drop off fairly quickly as they age, and as the you know, just the various asymmetries that come into play there. You know, when players stay with their teams, there's generally a reason for that. Part of it is because that team knows more about them than anybody else. The Giants know that they love Buster Posey's work habits. They're not going to ever let him hit the open market, whereas the Giants know about Pablo Sandoval's work habits. They're going to let him hit the open market and see what he can do. You know, obviously, I mean, there's situations like that where those decisions are vindicated time and time again, which is why the Pablo Sandovals and the Carl Crawfords and, you know, some of these guys wind up disappointing. Now, I can't say that that's necessarily true for Jason Hayward. You know, part of it was a unique circumstance that the Braves decided to steer themselves into the rebuilding process at a time when few people thought that that was really fully mandated. You know, and then the Cardinals really wanted to keep him, but he saw himself as having better opportunities elsewhere and, you know, places that he could be more comfortable. So he made his decision. So, you know, I think there's a lot of it there that is maybe more difficult to understand for the average fan. And it's not something that you're going to get, you know, in one conversation. It's something that I think you understand, you know, maybe after you've let yourself appreciate what, you know, start with the basics of defensive value, start with the basics of sabermetrics, and maybe you'll come around to that. But, you know, it's, every fan has a tendency to approach the game in their own way, and you can't just ram that stuff down people's throats and expect them to get that. You hope you can persuade them over time that this is the right way to look at things, but, you know, appreciate that there are other ways to enjoy baseball as well.
And we've held you quite some time. One final question, then we'll let you get the heck out of here. I appreciate you putting in all the time. Jay Jaffe here from SI.com. If you want to follow him on Twitter, it's @J_Jaffe. I'm going to ask you to put the crystal ball in display here. I'm going to ask you to be predictive. Give me the stories that we're talking about in August, both in the American League and the National League. Put on your prediction and say, wow, this is what happened, and this is the stunner or in National League. Write the story ahead of time, I guess. I'm trying to ask you to be a prophet here. Give me the stories for the American League and the National League.
Ah, geez, here. You know, I to quote Sterling Archer, I had something for this. I did a year-end preview for 2016, and now I'm damned if I can remember off the top of my head what it was here. In terms of some of the biggest stories here, if you give me 30 seconds, I can pull this up here and remind myself what some of those were here.
Take your time. I keep you here for a long time, and I don't make it easy on you. So by all means, take all the time you need to pull anything up there. I put people
okay,
on the
spot.
Okay,
I got
time.
It here. I mean, you know, I think that you know, the Cubs, you know, pursuing their first championship in 108 years is certainly one we're going to be talking about. I think the Astros and Blue Jays and Mets following up last year's breakouts, because I have all three of those teams going to the playoffs and actually winning their divisions is going to be another story. I think the Marlins being a circus act yet again, despite having a new manager and Don Mattingly and Barry Bonds as their hitting coach, is going to be a big story. I think David Ortiz's retirement obviously will be a big one. I think Ortiz, given the level that he has shown that he can produce even at his advanced age, you know, we could be looking at a guy who maybe has a chance to win a fourth ring here if everything breaks right. So those are some of the things. I think the new collective bargaining agreement, and negotiations over that and the implementation of this the takeout slide rule, and the other pace of game initiatives that have been introduced are going to get talked about. I don't think that's all going to be necessarily smooth. I think particularly that takeout slide thing is one of those things where I wouldn't be surprised at all if we have to see the league issue a clarification or two, as they did with the catcher plate blocking rule some of the instant replay rules. But, you know, those are things I think we'll be talking about. I think we'll be talking about the Cuban pipeline. And the way that that's evolving, because I know there's a lot going on behind the scenes there to try to make it to cut out the need to defect and to go through these human traffickers and, you know, to let players sign directly with teams. So I think that's going to be a story as well. And maybe possibly, hopefully, the Gurriel brothers signing with a team. They defected in February just before all this Cuba talk started heating up here. But we could at the very least, see Yulieski Gurriel sign with a team and hopefully make an impact down the stretch.
Did you pick a World Series tandem, a matchup,
yeah,
or no?
I've got Cubs over Astros.
And I think the Mets are going to regress a little bit, and I would love to talk with you about the Blue Jays in the future. But I couldn't come up with an argument to argue against the Cubs. They were too good last year, and it seems like the offseason they just got better. I would love to be able to be contrarian and find a way to say that the Cubs are going to regress, but I just can't find it. They're too good in my opinion. They look too good to even try to make an argument. Is that your opinion as well? They're just loaded essentially.
Well, I mean they're strong everywhere. I think the bullpen could use a little bit of help, but you look, they've got five guys who are 27 or under, including Hayward. All of them can be, you know, at least have some expectation of maintaining last year's level or improving. You know, and that includes Chris Bryant and Addison Russell, two guys who didn't get full years in. They've got the Cy Young winner and another ace in John Lester, and a quality third addition in John Lackey. That rotation can miss bats 1 through 5. You know, and they've got a great manager in Joe Maddon. So I think they have so many positives going for them that I think it's going to be very tough, to knock them down a peg. I think they're set up for a short series with that rotation. Again, the one thing I worry about is the bullpen, but I think that's the kind of thing you can fix on the fly. We saw them do a pretty good job of it late last year with random guys like Fernando Rodney and Trevor Cahill, whom they plucked off the scrap heap here. So it's worth keeping an eye on and remembering in case things don't go great on that front from day one.
Jay Jaffe from SI.com, I really appreciate you putting all the time. Thanks again. Hopefully we'll have you back on. But, again, really appreciate you putting in so much time to talk with us today. Great job, and thanks again.
All right, sure thing. Thanks.
Jay Jaffe from SI.com. Obviously, you heard the show. Phenomenal amount of information that he brings to the game. And we didn't even touch on anything close to the amount of stuff that I was hoping to get to. But he just, when he says something, I'm like, I have a follow-up question, and I want to know more details on this and more details on that. And before you know it, I've held them longer than I should have held them. I'm such a pain in the ass when it comes to that. I keep these people and these guests way longer than I probably should. They might be getting angry, but they're much too polite to let me know it. But I love to talk baseball. I love talking with these people, and it always ends up going longer than it probably should. And their patience and what they're able to do here, it's really fantastic. So thanks again to Jay Jaffe from SI.com for coming on. Head on over to SI.com to read all of his content. SI does a great job, and obviously Jay Jaffe does great stuff, and I love talking Hall of Fame stuff with him. I can't resist talking a little bit about it. I squeezed it in there, even though it really wasn't all that relevant to the overall show today, because I just like to get his thoughts and his perspective on the Hall of Fame, because it's just not something that I feel like I'm all that great with when it comes to evaluating these things, and he does a phenomenal job with it. But he does a great job. If you want to follow him on Twitter, I highly recommend you do. It's @J_JAFFE. @J_Jaffe. I'm your host, Chris Mitchell. You've been listening to A Podcast to Be Named Later. And if you like to follow us, you can always do that in a variety of different locations. If you want to know when the podcasts are airing, or you want links to the different podcasts we've already done, you can follow me on Twitter. It's @CJMitch73. We had some phenomenal guests this week. So I don't know if you should be following me on Twitter because of me. Maybe I'm too annoying to be following. But if anything, you should be following because of the quality of the guests we're having on these podcasts. We talked with George Kurtz from RotoExperts.com. We talked about baseball in general with a little bit of a sprinkle of fantasy analysis in there. And we talked with Ricky Sanders about daily fantasy sports. Obviously, today we talked with Jay Jaffe. We talked with, who was it earlier in the week as well? Chris Mitchell from Fangraphs. The same name. How did I forget that we talked with Chris Mitchell, my namesake, though he's not even related and he's not the same person. He's his own Chris Mitchell, does his fantasy, he does his prospect analysis over at Fangraphs. He has the Cato projecting system, which is a very interesting system. It essentially establishes a WAR score for prospects. And anyone who follows prospects and tries to follow them, it's not easy to find advanced metrics on minor leagues. There's so many teams, so many players, so many leagues. It's just difficult to find advanced stats and to be able to put together the kind of metrics you'd like to put together to have a WAR score. And to be honest, again, I'm a little skeptical about just how much you should follow WAR. I think you should. I believe you should look at all stats and just know that there are some limitations to them. Prospects, I'm very interested to see how this Cato projecting system goes, how successful it is moving forward. And really the only way that we'll really be able to evaluate it is the rankings versus the major league success. That at the end of the day, if these highly ranked Cato guys end up being stars, is it because the Cato system works, or is it because they were already supposed to be stars and the Cato system is just mimicking that? Or, and there's another way it could go, and Chris Mitchell does great work, so it could definitely go this way. the Cato system may grab stats and grab things out of their performances and looking at their numbers, and it may identify things that we don't really fully understand or we don't recognize it, and he may pick out a bunch of players that we didn't see coming and end up being very accurate and predictive. That could definitely happen, and to me, that's what's going to be interesting. Predicting that Byron Buxton or Corey Seager is going to be a good player, any system can do that. I can do that. You can throw darts and do that, really. If you want to put a list of the first-round picks up there on a wall and start throwing darts, you're going to come out with some successful selections there. So that if the Cato projection system does that, I'm not going to give it a whole ton of credit, but I think it'll do better than that. Chris Mitchell is a very talented writer and a very knowledgeable baseball guy, so I have no doubt that he's putting together a system that's going to be helpful. And I'm just curious to see how helpful and how successful it can be, because he's going to have to pick out those guys that we didn't know. Paul Goldschmidt's a good example. He's one of, if not the best player in baseball. I think you can make an argument that he might be the best player in baseball. With everything that he does on defense and offense and even running, for a first baseman to steal the number of bases he steals, I mean, he does so much extremely well. He was not projected to be a superstar prospect. When he was drafted, there were limitations to his game. There was concerns with how much contact he would make. It just didn't look like he was going to be a superstar, and obviously now he is. If a Cato system can identify those players before it happens, that'll be the way that we know if the system is successful or not. But either way, we talked minor league prospects earlier in the week with him, and we talked about his Cato projection system. So phenomenal week. George Kurtz, Chris Mitchell, Jay Jaffe, Ricky Sanders talking daily fantasy sports. We talked about that. So lots of fantastic guests this week, and we're hoping to have more. Joe Sheehan has said that he's going to come on the program. Joe Posnanski has committed to coming on the program. I'm hoping to get them on as soon as we can. We're going to do some team breakdowns for 2016 with those guys. Probably about 3 or 4 weeks ago was the plan, but it was just wasn't in the cards. It just didn't end up happening. But I'm hoping to be able to get them on the program in the future. We'll have George Kurtz back on. Lenny Melnick, the legendary fantasy player, hopefully we'll get him back on the program. Hopefully we'll get Rob Nyer back. Jim Callis is always comes on the program. I look forward to having him back on. Vince Lara from Baseball America. I'm not trying to tout names or anything like this when it comes to bragging or anything. These are just people that have committed before, and I'm hoping we'll be able to get them back on the program here in the coming weeks and months ahead. So it's going to be a fantastic baseball season. And hopefully we'll have a lot of fantastic guests for you to be listening here on a podcast to be named later. If you'd like to make suggestions as far as topics or refer people that could be guests for some reason or another, we'd be more than happy to do that. I love talking baseball with all of you out there. So you can do that over on Facebook in the long form. Head on over to our Facebook group and ask to be invited in, and I'll approve your request. It's a podcast to be named later on Facebook. If you want to listen to all of our podcasts or find links to all the previous podcasts that I've done throughout the winter and where you'll be able to find me throughout the upcoming spring and summer, head on over to minorleagueball.com. If you'd like to read my minor league prospect analysis from a fantasy perspective, and I do that over at rotoexperts.com. So there's lots of different places. I write for Baseball America. I wrote for minorleagueball.com, and I also write for rotoexperts.com. So those are all the different locations you can find me if you want to read my content. But the easiest way to do it, follow me on Twitter. You'll come across some links. And you can message me on there if you have any questions as well, at CJMitch73. Again, thanks, Jay Jaffe, for coming on the program. Did a fantastic job. Really great to having him on board. But thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Enjoy opening weekend. Sunday, games begin. Monday, the insanity fully goes into effect. I can't wait till baseball gets up and running. I can't wait to be able to turn on the television and watch games that matter essentially every single minute of the day from noon to 2 a.m. at night. Fantastic. Baseball is a great. Baseball is just plain great. Thanks, everybody. Stay good. Be safe. Watch baseball.